Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Medicine, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Claire Clark, one of the hosts on the channel, and today we'll be talking to Joseph Davis about his new book, Chemically Imbalanced Everyday Suffering, Medication, and Our Troubled Quest for Self-Mastery. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Claire. I'm delighted to be here.
I wonder if you could begin our interview by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Nothing particularly outstanding, but I have a background. I studied at the University of Minnesota with a background in anthropology. And then later, actually in my 30s, I went back to graduate school here at the University of Virginia and did a PhD in cultural sociology. Otherwise, I have a family, three children. And work here at the university at a research center called the Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture, which, as the name suggests, we do focus on culture and cultural change and how kind of the world we're living in is being transformed before our very eyes. I've been here since the late 90s, so long time.
And how did you come to write Chemically Imbalanced?
Well, it was a kind of follow-up, in a way, from a book I wrote earlier called Accounts of Innocence, Sexual Abuse, Trauma in the Self. And that was a study of really centered around psychotherapy and a psychotherapy for adult survivors of childhood sexual abuse. And it was, I wrote that and began studying about it in the 90s when all the concern about recovered memories. There was a lot of talk about that and so on, and I wrote some about that phenomena. But I was coming at it from a question of a philosophical, anthropological question, the question of what it means to be human. And I got interested in how people account for themselves in situations in which there's trouble, what I will talk about, I think, of everyday suffering, and how you account for it, how you explain it, right? Like what happened. And because the account of what happened is quite critical to what you do about it. So they're the kind of reciprocal interaction there. So that particular psychotherapy was a kind of window on accounts people give that in turn kind of reflect what we think it means to be human. Questions of philosophical anthropology, we usually think of it as abstract kind of philosophical question. But it's really at the heart of how we imagine our life and understand human affairs. We've done a number of projects here. We have one on aging. In fact, the book comes out later this month called The Evening of Life from Notre Dame. That was based on a conference we did exploring the question around aging and the life course. We did one on algorithmic decision making and governance. But you could go on and on, right? How we raise our children, organize our schools, formulate our social policies, manage our work lives, et cetera. All of those, in some ways deal with this question, what it means to be human. And so that's really been a kind of guiding thread of my work. And I came across, so after, while I was finishing Accounts of Innocence, I began to see all these drug ads that began to appear in the early 2000s which were really interesting because they provide a kind of account for people in a kind of nice condensed 1 minute form. You get a kind of explanation about why your life has gone the way it has. And they weren't really, anyone who's seen drug ads knows they're not really directed at people with mental illness in what we normally think of that term meaning. But they really are directed at kind of helping him find a better life or have a better life.
With treating what you call everyday suffering, essentially.
Yeah, exactly.
So can you say a little bit more about what is, because it's a key concept in the book, what is everyday suffering? And then, you know, how does it relate to conditions that have diagnoses like attention deficit disorder or generalized anxiety disorder?
Yeah, it's a term, and since I invented, in other contexts, sometimes people will talk about like ordinary suffering or something like that. And it may be a better way to say the term is suffering in everyday life, where everyday life is actually is kind of a technical term in social theory, referring kind of to the arena of the kind of practical and felt experience of everyday life for people. It's where we engage in kind of practical activity, our relationships. Everyday life is guided by our implicit common sense knowledge and understandings, often used as kind of natural language. And it's everyday life is set against a kind of specialized, elite kind of focused interpretations. So if you're in seeing your psychoanalyst and he starts talking about the Oedipal complex, you're no longer in the realm of everyday life. All right. But if you're talking with your friends about, you know, the anxiety you're experiencing and something like that, that's more of the realm of the everyday. And I wanted a phrase that would be a non-medical way of talking about suffering, about, you know, experiences of humiliation and of not measuring up. Of not living up to one's potential, the very things that people were telling me in the interviews that I wanted to treat as very serious. They're very painful experiences, but I wanted to talk about them in a way that is not in a medical framework. The medical framework, it seems to me, leads us astray in almost every way. And so I had to make a distinction. And, you know, if you ask a psychiatrist, right, it's very difficult to draw a distinction between. Something like a DSM category. When do you have generalized anxiety disorder, and when you just have the worries of everyday life? And those things are not, drawing sharp boundaries is very tricky. But the point was just that it seemed to me we need a way of talking about these experiences that's not medical. And so that was the idea. It's in everyday life, but it's also a kind of suffering. Meaning it's not trivial. And I found kind of three criteria or things that people said that seemed to me to be critical to the idea of the suffering. One was emotional distress. Second was it involves some kind of affront to yourself, either your social, your self-understanding or your social standing, right? So something of the self was deeply implicated in this kind of suffering. And then also that had a sense of abnormality. All right. In other words, there wasn't a kind of ready explanation, right? It raised this question, which I call a predicament, raised the question of why is this happening to me? What's going wrong? That wasn't obvious to participants in the interviews, right? And it seemed to me, so those three features, it seemed to me, were critical for the understanding of the suffering. And all of them add to the suffering, right? The fact that it's not readily explainable. Right, add some of the pain to the suffering, right? Because it was like people didn't want it to be happening to them, but they didn't know what was causing it. And that would distinguish it in some ways from a lot of our everyday experience that might be painful, but we know exactly why we're experiencing it, right? Like grief, one can experience grief. Grief is painful, but we know why. And so in a sense, grief is not a form of everyday suffering in the way I'm using the term, even though there's obviously emotional distress.
That makes a lot of sense. But can we back up a bit and maybe you can tell our listeners who you were talking to, you know, that, so tell us about the methods that you used to research the book and where these accounts were coming from. Did you have any really surprising interview findings or any interviews that's really shaped your thinking or sort of have stuck with you?
Oh, yeah. I'm getting a little ahead of the game here. What I did was set out to interview, actually originally set out to interview 100 people. I interviewed 80. I won't go into the reason for reducing the number, but the way we did it was posted advertisements recruiting people who had experiences with either being, I think the ad went something like, right, if they had struggled with being sad, with being anxious in social situations, or with concentration or attention problems, and then whether they might be willing to talk about any of those experiences. And I picked those three areas, which kind of map on if there's a diagnosis to depression, social anxiety, and ADHD, because those are three of the most common problems, you know, reported by people in America, forms of mental distress. And then we put up the ads on like Craigslist. We posted them in all these kind of weekly, alternative weekly newspapers that a lot of cities have. We put them on college campuses, public kiosks, at libraries, you know, places where you can put up posters and so on. And we did it in Chicago, Boston, Baltimore, and here in the Charlottesville, Central Virginia, Charlottesville and Harrisonburg, which are smaller cities. We had some exclusion criteria. I was interested in people whose experience could be characterized as everyday suffering. And so we created some exclusion criteria with the intention of excluding people who had serious mental illness. So we excluded people who had ever been hospitalized for a condition, had been on certain drugs that are like the antipsychotics that are normally for treating people who have psychotic conditions like schizophrenia or manic depressive illness, and so on. So it was kind of people called an 800 number, and then there was a kind of screening questionnaire that we went through, and that way kind of screened out people who had unproblematically conditions we think of as a mental illness. So that was the method for the interviews. And then we did interviews with persons who lasted about 2 hours, that asked them to talk about their experience and so on. You asked about what maybe the most surprising finding in the book. Let me also add this. A qualitative study like this, we only interviewed 80 people. A qualitative study like this is not intended to really find new things that no one ever knew. Right. Often what we do in creating the interview instrument and so on is work off of understandings that are already some ways already known, often through survey data or other kinds of data. Right. I already knew that it was common for people to cite things like chemical imbalance in their experience, that language is out there, various kinds of study of the media and so on show that, et cetera. So I wasn't surprised that people talked in the language of chemical imbalance, for instance. But I was surprised at how mechanistic the language people used about their own experience, how much they had kind of adopted a medicalized way of talking, right? Like words like anxiety and depression, right? That people used and would often refer to all their emotional experience, right? Just using a very small number of words, right? For instance, my anxiety, and so on. And almost every bad feeling is subsumed under a few categories that people had. That I was surprised by. Or just how casual people's references were to drug names and diagnostic categories, just how widely those have penetrated popular culture and people's everyday lives, right? The casual references that people made to the workings of the brain, right? Or serotonin or dopamine, right? These words just flow off people's tongues like they're, you know, kind of everyday words now. And I was surprised by that, right? Or even the kind of how they decided what was deviant and what was normal and so on. And a lot of this reflecting clearly a lot of exposure to these concepts and ideas. And so that, I think that's probably perhaps the most surprising finding was this, the way people talked clearly had been very influenced by a certain a kind of popular level, kind of psychiatric language.
I found that surprising too. And maybe it's because I hang out with too many academics for whom categories are always, you know, contested. These kinds of terms are up for debate, but just how pervasive you kind of coin a concept that you call the neurobiological imaginary to describe this phenomenon. At the end of the book, you conclude that the neurobiological imaginary, that there's a reductionism in it, but it's not a biological reduction. And I thought that was that's sort of a key point, that so when people are reducing all of their emotional psychological experience to, oh, I'm chemically imbalanced, there's something more complicated going on than biological reductionism. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about that.
It's a little tricky to say in a brief space. So, but let me make a couple of comments. And in that context, that it wasn't a biological, it's not a biological reduction in the stories that ordinary people tell. In the sense that they do not, they don't really think of their behavior as determined by biology in any strong sense of the term. Instead, the references to biology in their stories were really ways, you might say, to kind of offload experience from the self. I ask them, like, what does chemical imbalance mean? And so on, right? No one could really give an answer. And nor did they seem interested in giving an answer or seem interested in what a chemical imbalance might mean. It was clear it meant something in their stories. It pointed to something that was not self, and so on, that brought it about. As one interviewee, how did she say it? Something to the effect of, you know, I just have too much or too little of whatever causes these problems. Mm-hmm. You know, that was her way of describing her chemical imbalance. And so the science of it wasn't really in discussion. People didn't, you know, I think they kind of assumed there was some science out there that someone understood, but they really didn't make much reference to that. I think what I say in the book is it's not a biological reduction. It's a kind of reduction of our humanness, of our sense of being humans, in the way that it, by talking like that, right. And kind of externalizing, problems and difficulties and so on in that way, that really did undermine, our the very sources of individual agency. And so I think it had that we're in some sense selling ourselves short, in that kind of talk, rather than thinking of ourselves, in biological terms, if you will.
Yeah. And I mean, you talk about it as involving a kind of splitting off, like where I just chalk up every form of suffering I've had to something wrong with my brain, then I can divorce myself from those experiences. I interview quite a few historians of medicine on this channel, and they, if any of them are listening, might want to know that you have got a whole chapter in this book, essentially devoted to the history of psychiatry. Could you say a little bit about, how did the history of psychiatry lead us up to this point kind of the reductive nature of the neurobiological imaginary?
Oh, yeah. The way I center the history, which it leads up to the third edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual in 1980, the so-called DSM-3, which is really the revolution and the critical turning point. And I think virtually every historian of these things will cite the DSM-3. It's a really significant break. But I argue that the shift toward biology is really centered on the drugs. The drugs that begin to come on the market, these new drugs for the mind that begin to come on the market in the 1950s. Originally, the first really centered on psychosis with chlorpromazine and so on. And then what followed with so-called minor tranquilizers, particularly Miltown. And then we have Librium and Valium. And these drugs are extremely popular through the 50s and 60s and 70s. Valium was like the best-selling drug in the world for about 15 years and so on. And those drugs, there was, the question the drug forced was, right, how do they work? How is it possible that a drug can help people feel better for problems, that we think of as problems of the mind? And it was, in a crucial way, and it's not the only thing that was going on. Certainly, I try to at least hint at a variety of other changes that are going on in psychiatry and the move away from psychoanalysis, particularly in the importance of diagnosis as medicine becomes increasingly bureaucratized. But it was in some ways the pursuing of this question of drugs and how they work. And that's when you first begin to get ideas that what the drugs are affecting are neurotransmitters like serotonin, like dopamine, right? And in fact, the ones we talk about, norepinephrine, the ones we talk about are actually all the ones that were talked about in the 1950s, even though we now recognize there are probably more than 100 different neurotransmitters. But at the time, those were the ones that we knew about. And it was a kind of new discovery how those work. And you get the idea, and it's a kind of working backwards from drug effect to cause. So if the drug effect affects the uptake of, say, serotonin or the reuptake of serotonin or dopamine or something like that, then maybe the cause of the problem, the cause of the depression, is somehow an inadequacy or a shortage, say, of serotonin. And that's when you get the shorthand was a chemical imbalance, right? People who are depressed have some kind of shortage of serotonin in their brain. And what the drug does is it blocks the reuptake, increasing the amount of serotonin available in the brain, in the synapses, and that then leads to recovery or an improvement in the condition. And that idea, it was first developed in the mid-60s, and then I think re-energized the field of psychiatry, which had increasingly was using these drugs, right, to rethink their categories and what's at the bottom, and particularly with the idea that we're now going to get to the biological foundations of mental illness, right? Medicine is really about the body. And psychiatry was always a kind of secondary, marginal field because it dealt with people's problems and their complexes and stuff like that. It didn't really deal with the body. And I think the drugs opened up this possibility that finally psychiatry would become a real part of medicine, right? It will then work toward discovering the biology of mental illness and new kinds of treatments and so on that would address the pathophysiology of mental disorder or the genetic roots of it and so on. And so this was a great promise, and it drove the development of the DSM-3, a redefinition of the categories, the movement away from psychoanalysis. And what happens after the DSM-3 is that there's an explosion of kind of drug only. Before that, back in the 60s and 50s, drugs were largely seen to be as adjuncts, like the psychotherapy. After 1980, it begins to move in a decidedly different direction. And then perhaps, especially after the introduction of Prozac in the late 80s, in which now more and more people are treated only with a drug. Therapy has declined dramatically, and now people are just treated with a drug and so on. And it's conceived in some sense as a biological problem. I might add that currently psychiatry doesn't think the chemical imbalance idea has been somewhat debunked because they just couldn't show it. And there are treatments for depression that help where you actually reduce the amount of serotonin rather than increase it, et cetera, et cetera. So that idea has been kind of marginalized and complexified, right? That whatever else is going on, it's much more complex than any simple chemical imbalance. But I do think psychiatry is still very much wedded to a biological model. Now they just want to complexify it, right? And add other things, second messenger systems and other stuff. But it does seem to me that they're still after finding the biological roots of mental illness. And so in that sense, even while chemical imbalance has been somewhat displaced, it does seem to me it's still heavily biological.
And of course, the medication hasn't gone away. Bringing us up to the research that you did, about half of the people that you talked to were on a medication, and then about two thirds had sought some form of professional help, whether that was psychiatric or psychological to alleviate their everyday suffering. I wonder, how did some of these people come to, you use the word appropriate disorder categories. You mentioned generalized anxiety disorder, ADHD, for themselves. So how did they come to identify with disorders?
Right. And that's the, I think, crucial word is kind of identify with. I didn't find that people approached a disorder like generalized anxiety like they might approach something like diabetes, right? Which is a common analogy that people make, say depression is just like diabetes. Mm-hmm. But people did not approach depression like diabetes. Where you just kind of accept the doctor says you have it and you sort of accept that. And then you proceed to follow the directions that you're given to treat it. I draw a concept from the anthropologist Peter Stromberg. The phrase he uses is the impression point. It's a way of talking about a kind of how a subjective connection is made between a category of experience, between a category like generalized anxiety disorder, depression, and one's experience. Like, how does one subjectively make that connection? And it's something of a kind of aha moment when that happens, right? And when the symbolism of the diagnosis, right, takes on some kind of personal meaning, they make a personal connection. And this came in a lot of different ways that people described. So, for instance, one not uncommon one was for people to compare themselves to someone they knew, right? So, these ideas are floating around amongst people. They've read the media, they've seen drug ads and so on. So they have this kind of vocabulary. And by a certain point, almost everybody knew someone who was on something. And so often they would compare their experience. So they'd talk with a friend and the friend would say, I felt this and I went on this medication and so on. And people sometimes in the context of those conversations would say, oh, wow, it hit me. You know, we have the same thing, right? We're suffering from the same problem. Or another form was that someone would just suggest it to them. I remember in one case, a woman and a friend, a couple of couples, they're leaving a restaurant. And apparently the one woman during dinner had shared a little bit about her struggles. And on the way out, the other woman says to her, you know, there's something you can take for that, right? Mm-hmm. And then it never occurred to her that this was, it probably never occurred to her that she actually had a medical problem in the first place. And the woman said, there's something you can take for that. And that was the moment she's, right? And then she pursues getting a medication. Or maybe a third one, and this is really common, is that people have seen representations of this in the media. I remember one woman I interviewed, she was talking about how she had seen a drug ad, and she identified, they were kind of presenting the symptoms of depression, right? And she says, you know, something to the effect that, you know, she's relating to them. She said, that's my experience, right? You see your own experience in what's being listed on the screen, right? And then she has that kind of aha moment. And by implication here, a lot of the people I interviewed went to the doctor already having made this identification and then seeking a medication. So they sometimes would refer to this as a self-diagnosis. I think that's a somewhat misleading term. But the point is they've already kind of made this appropriation of a disorder category. They've identified their experience with it. And often have already been exposed to talk about the drug or have looked at drug websites and so on. And then they go in and kind of present the case to the doctor. And of course, the drug advertising is intended to help people make that appropriation, right? That's the very point of it. This direct-to-consumer advertising is for you to make the connection, right? And then they'll say things like, you know, ask your doctor today. And the point is, right, is to start this appropriation process, right? And then you go to the doctor and they actually help give you the language to describe your experience. And they have checklists and things which actually provide a vocabulary that if you then use with the doctor, right, he's liable to think you have it because you're now talking in terms of lack of sleep or, you know, the kinds of experiences that are in the checklist and so on. So and again, I think this is different than a lot of regular medical conditions. And this often wasn't a passive process, but an active process. And when people kind of made the connection, occasionally they would do it with the doctor. The doctor might bring it up. But that was somewhat unusual. Actually, it was more common for people that already made the connection.
That they were inspired by kind of social and cultural factors, you know, and then they would have some help medicalizing their everyday suffering.
Yeah, that's right. Especially in their like family and friends, people had already talked with, you know, people, you know, typically the first person they talk to is not a doctor. It's people around them. Those who are close to them, confidants and so on. And so they would talk with them. And there's this language circulating, you know, I refer to it as the healthscape, you know, kind of the landscape of health. This healthscape is very popular. And so it was in those contexts, it was often in relationships with other people that they would have these kind of aha moments when they were kind of, you know, sharing about their experience. And then the other person saying, oh, well, you know, I know this, or I've done this, or I know this person who did that.
Yeah. So medicalizing this everyday suffering, you know, where people come to call it, say, oh, I'm having trouble concentrating. I have ADHD, or, oh, I'm a nervous person. I have, you know, generalized anxiety disorder. It changes the way, you know, the book really articulates how that changes the way that people think about and relate to themselves and their own experience. But does it also, you know, I mean, one of the arguments made in favor of medicalization is that it reduces stigma. So I wonder, does it also change the way other people perceive them, in the sense that, like, if you can sort of claim a diagnosis, then is that somehow less stigmatizing?
First off, there's now a pretty considerable body of research showing that medicalizing problems, in other words, putting them into some kind of biological framework, does not reduce stigma. In fact, if anything, it increases it. In my case, what I would say is that the way people frame their experience, I call it in the book a third condition. In other words, people who are suffering from this kind of everyday suffering often would distance themselves from the psychiatric category. They'd say things like, oh, yeah, I was diagnosed with, social anxiety. That's what the doctor calls it. But I don't call it, I call it just my anxiety. And there was a lot of symbolic distancing from the category, sometimes a kind of rejection of them, sometimes a kind of passive, like, yeah, okay, that's what it's called. But I think of it differently. So they had their own ways. And I refer to this as a third condition. In other words, they would situate themselves not as mentally ill, but also not normal either, right? So in other words, it was justified and appropriate, say, that they take a medication, for those who are taking medication, right? And that meant that they weren't just the same as everyone else. There was something wrong, but it's not mental illness. And so they position themselves in the middle. I call that a third condition. But one of the downsides of that, or the pernicious consequences of that, is that it's a kind of identifying that then sets you apart from the mentally ill. And in the process, then people would have very, and I think kind of increasingly stigmatized views of the mentally ill, because you're defining yourself against them, right? I'm not like them. The mentally ill are crazy. The mentally ill are dangerous. The mentally ill are, and I'm not like that, right? And so it creates a kind of tension. One of these kind of identity moves, right, where you're defining yourself against something, this seemed to me led to the even more stigmatizing views of the mentally ill and of our people with schizophrenia and these serious conditions.
Right. It's not creating a coalition, right, of people who are interested in advocating for mental health. Everybody, the number of people who are now walking around with generalized anxiety disorder, for example.
I didn't see a lot of solidarity.
No.
The opposite. Plus, I might mention these conditions, because they're not that serious in the sense that they don't involve a psychotic experience and so on, are easy to, the only people who knew about it were the people they told. So it's not the kind of thing that is visible to other people. So what that meant was that people were very careful about who they revealed their experience to. And it often was one or two people in their life. This wasn't something that, and so most other people simply didn't know about it. So in that sense, they didn't experience any stigma in the sense of some kind of discrimination, say, or bad treatment, because the people around them just simply didn't know about it. They could control access to that information. And that would be different, say, than someone who might have been hospitalized for a psychiatric, ways in which their experience does, in fact, can be seen by other people. And that's a very different experience.
Right. So it didn't create, the people experiencing everyday suffering didn't experience the effects of stigma, but their existence stigmatize other psychiatric conditions.
Yeah. Right. Well, the way they talked about them or thought about their experience, the defining of their experience involved defining it against mental illness. And I think that makes the mentally ill their other, right. And you, when you other someone, right? It's usually, you know, you somehow want to distinguish your status from theirs. And this can be a very, and there's a lot of, you know, clearly a lot of stigma and a lot of stigmatizing and prejudice and stereotypes. They involve anothering, right? In which we other those who, right? We want to, I'm not like them, you know, et cetera. So I think if anything, one, we know from all these studies that the biological does not reduce stigma by itself. And I think to that, I would add that it also seems like treating everyday suffering as a mental illness, it does not help the people who are truly mentally ill and who truly do need help. Both, one could add, at the level that resources are shifted off, medical resources are shifted off to people who probably don't need them and or need something else, and that the picture of mental illness, it seems to me, actually kind of gets worse. It doesn't increase appreciation or empathy. It actually reduces it because we're othering people rather than empathizing.
So I was a bit, I was blown away by your book's conclusion. In graduate school, for one of my comprehensive exams, I read books by Philip Reeve and Christopher Lash, and all of these criticisms of the psychologization of culture, right, that were made about a half century ago. And you have a very different take on that. So towards the end of the book, you conclude that the disappearance of this psychologizing worldview has actually led to a crisis of spirit, which is sort of like the reverse of what the critics in the late 20th century thought it was going to do. So I wonder if you could just, can you summarize your conclusion for us?
I don't know that I'm actually that far from Reef and Lash. Those are also, you know, very influential people in my kind of scholarly formation. But I think what I see happening that again, actually, I think Lash and someone would be sympathetic to was not psychology in the sense of what goes on in most clinical psychological settings. For instance, my earlier book, Accounts of Innocence, is quite critical of that kind of talk, those kinds of explorations and so on that are problematic. But I think what I'm suggesting is that attention to the inner life, right, is actually quite critical. And one of the effects of the biological turn is to turn away from the questions of one's inner life, right? How the very sources of our agency are tied up, right, with our personal and social history, right? How we frame what matters to us and so on, that gets marginalized or treated as unimportant, right? You just simply have some kind of brain malfunction. Our social circumstances, right, the context in which we live, is marginalized, is pushed out of the picture, right? In drug ads, the person, the sufferer, is never shown in any context. They're just, right, something has just gone wrong with the wiring in their brain, and so on. And I think that move away from the inner life is actually quite detrimental. There's a kind of use of the word psychology that means something more like just the stuff of our mind, the science of our mind, the study of our mind, and so on. When philosophers talk about moral psychology, that's what they mean. Not so much a profession, an academic field, or the clinical psychology. I think we just need a richer psychology, one that I think of as maybe a kind of critical phenomenology or critical hermeneutic psychology that would explore the ways in which a richer and more accurate understanding of ourselves, right, that would in fact involve our temporality, our memories, our history, the social practices that we're caught up in and the circumstances of our lives, our dialogic relations, both with others and with ourselves, our kind of internal conversation, the situatedness of that within a tradition, and so on. There's a lot of good work, I think, going on in phenomenology, reconsidering questions of psychopathology and so on in terms of our kind of being in the world. So what we need is a richer, more accurate picture of ourselves, our struggles, the way we interact with each other, the way we check our interpretations against our own background, the facts of our own history. It's reflective. We pay attention to our emotions. We read our emotions not as some external thing, but as actually telling us something about ourselves. And we keep in the picture, and this is the critical part, we keep in the picture the normative world in which we actually live. What kind of pressure is being brought to bear on us, right? How are we supposed to think of ourselves as being efficient and autonomous and so on? It's not a brief for just any kind of psychology, but what we need, and which I think psychiatry is in a troubled position because it's something of loss, is a kind of something that's not the biological, right, which hasn't really produced much. Most of its ambitions have not been realized on the one side. And then on the other side, they gave up on psychoanalysis, and you don't really have a kind of thick, rich, hermeneutic way of thinking about human persons and about our experience and how it relates. And I think that some of the phenomenologists are trying to supply that, trying to help us think about our engagement with the world that takes account both of our own history, our own personality, our own ideas, and so on, but also in conversation with the larger world, the kind of relation between the self and society, this our subjective experience, and then the social structures and so on in which we live.
It seems like it's not just a sort of a question that's internal to psychiatry and the way that it practices or different, you know, psychological therapeutic practices. It's that this change, you know, for the majority of people to come to think of themselves, for people to come to think of themselves in this way, and you're, and chemically imbalanced suggests that most people today just don't. It seems like there'd have to be some major cultural shifts. Do you have like any? I mean, I'll just speak for myself here. I was very dispirited at the end of this book because it seemed this major cultural shift is something that you're calling for and something that is needed. But I don't know, how do you get people to listen to phenomenologists? any ideas?
Right. Yeah. Well, actually, I'm just working on something on this question. Was the phenomenologist, it's a kind of reconceptualization that rather than introduce some kind of technical language, really works with people's natural language for how they think about and describe their experience, get a richer description of your experience and so on. And I do think one of the problems that my study found was how much people have already kind of abandoned natural language for thinking about their experience. I said earlier, I was so surprised by the kind of thin kind of mechanistic language that people would often use, the lack of emotion terms. So there's something like, there's more than 400 words in the English language for various emotions. I think people in my study must have used about a half a dozen. I think that's a real problem for a richer phenomenological kind of way of speaking, because a crucial thing for understanding our emotions is being able to identify what they are, right, and what might be right? Is that jealousy I'm experiencing? Is that envy? Right? Is that shame? Is that guilt? Is that, you know, that those, you know, they specify different things, and they specify how they might relate to us, what we feel is important, right? These are like windows on our own concerns. Our emotions are commentaries on our concerns. But it means being able to reflect on an emotion and see it somewhat accurately, so that you can then you can see, okay, what's at stake here? Why am I feeling this way? Right? So that does call for a kind of deprofessionalizing almost of the way we see ourselves in the world.
Versus what so many of the interviewees in your book do, rather than, you know, name an emotion and think about the context and think about its root, which is to say, oh, there goes my neurochemistry again. And let me just set it aside and power ahead. So.
Right. Yeah. So, I don't know what the, I don't have, you know, an easy answer. I think of my kind of sociology is at least helping to kind of identify a problem or pick out certain kinds of consequences that one understanding might have versus another. But it is a deeply cultural problem, a kind of thinning view of ourselves. As I said earlier, it's a kind of reduction of ourselves. A thinning perspective on our own life and our own, I can't say I have a.
Well, if I can use some reductive language, your book does a wonderful job of diagnosing it.
Here we go. the cure. I'm not. I think the phenomenologists are really moving in the direction of this would be a richer way to do psychiatry and a richer way to think about psychology and people's experience. And I do think there's at least some, I see some movement, right? People kind of frustrated by their experience with drugs. They don't often deliver, everybody I talked to who had been on a medication for the most part credited with helping them. But usually it helping them in the sense of taking the edge off certain emotional experiences. Or like they weren't able to sleep and they took the medication and they were able to sleep. And just doing that by itself will help people feel better or take the sharp edge off emotions and things like that. And I do think that's a value to medication for that kind of short term, especially kind of crisis intervention, right? If you're crying all the time, it's really difficult to actually, you know, think about anything else. So if the medication can help do that, but also then I think there's been a lot of discontent with the drug experience, right? They work for a while, then they stop working. You're constantly changing the medications, the dosages. It could be a real roller coaster to be on a medication. So I think that there's been some pushback about this idea of medication only as a kind of treatment. People are dissatisfied with it. I think there's a growing body of evidence about the long-term and negative consequences of being on some of these kinds of medications and the ways in which they affect brain chemistry over the longer term, make it much more difficult to get off them and so on. And I think, I hope that kind of something of the dream or the kind of, you know, the drug's going to fix everything, that image is sort of worn off, and we might be able to use the drugs in more appropriate ways, often limited ways. So I do think there may be some hunger for like alternative ways of thinking about our experience. And I do think the work of some of the phenomenologists who have been thinking about these things and trying to find richer, more thick, if you will, ways of talking about our experience, reflecting on our experience and so on, that those would have some kind of, they would find a more receptive audience, perhaps, than they have when there was this idea that you could just fix the problem with a pill. I think that idea is running into trouble because it turns out you don't just fix it with a pill. It's not that simple.
I certainly I hope so. I think, well, Joe, we have taken up a lot of your time. Could you tell us what you're researching now?
Oh yeah. So I'm working on a new book. I'm calling it at the moment, these titles go under change, Troubles of Youth. And so it's an effort to kind of focus in on this high rates of distress that are reported by basically high school and college age people. So in that, whatever, 16 to 22, 23 age range, and, you know, as you know, there's really high rates of reported depression, anxiety, ADHD, you know, one in five high school boys has an ADHD diagnosis, and so on. So there are very high reports of distress. And I was trying to kind of think about what's behind that. And here I want to kind of bring some social theory to bear on, and particularly around the question of what you might call chosen identity, the idea that you author your own life, and how this might affect young people who get this message at younger and younger ages, in which they're trying to author themselves. And I want to explore how that affects the race of problems and how that leads to certain problems. And so I'm working with interviews with parents and then also with some survey data we have on young people and so on. And I'm actually hoping that's a less academic, more like a trade book.
Well, it sounds like a wonderful project, and
it's it kind of, you know, works off of this previous project in the sense of a lot of what seemed to me I saw going on there and heard in interviews. So when I kind of explore how that might lead, how might the social expectations, right, let's say on young people to stand out and be unique, right, and optimize themselves and so on, how that may lead to a lot of distress.
Well, Joe, we have taken up so much of your time. I want to thank you for being, again, for taking time to talk to us and for being on the show. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you, Claire. And I really appreciate the interest in this research and the opportunity to talk about it.